Hey everybody, Ken here from This Show Is So Gay. Becca and I decided to take a break this evening, a pause where we could look back over the past year and deconstruct the hilarity, the insight, and the insanity of our little gay radio show. And nowhere is there more to deconstruct than with our amazing guests. Here's the thing, every time one of our guests consents to being on our show, we are in shock, we are in awe. These are some of the most incredible LGBT and ally role models around, and it's a true honor to speak with them. So we wanted to give you a chance to relive with us just some of our favorite moments, ones you might have missed and ones that are just not to be missed. On November 19th, 2008, NPR's justice correspondent Ari Shapiro called in. We knew he was accomplished, we knew he was dreamy, but who knew he was such a superhero? Enjoy.
It's good times. And with that, we welcome tonight's guest to our show. Ari Shapiro, are you there?
I'm here. Hey, Ken. Hey, Becca.
Hello.
How's it going? We got dressed up for you and everything, Ari.
Oh, thank you. You know, I get dressed up every time I'm on the radio.
Do you?
So listeners will know I care about them.
You're very well dressed in the picture, so we have that assumption already.
Oh, yeah. Everybody comes to work at NPR in tuxedos. It's a rule you can't go into the studio and sit in front of the microphone unless you're at least wearing a jacket and tie.
Can we jump right to that?
The engineer will give you one, yeah.
Carl Castle, you've met him?
He's like a wonderful Wilford Brimley-esque, brilliant, grandfatherly icon of journalism.
Because I must tell you, this is my NPR week, because this week last year was my contestant gig on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
You were a contestant?
I was.
Did you win?
I did win. I couldn't.
What did Carl say on your voicemail?
He was just classic. I got to loop that up here on this show one night. But he said I was a NPR special correspondent in the field. It just made me sound much more important, Ari, than.
You know, one of my favorite things about that show is that they still use the term answering machine, even though nobody in America owns an answering machine anymore.
They do here.
I do
here in Vermont, Ari.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I do. I also own a radio.
No, they have a whole, on the corner store, there's a Birkenstock answering machine special if you buy both.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Ari, we have so much to talk to you about. It's hard to even know where to begin, but we're going to start.
All yours.
Okay. Tell us about that song that we just listened to first, before we even get to stuff.
So the first time I ever hosted Weekend Edition Sunday, I've been lately filling in as a guest host on various shows. Last week I was hosting Morning Edition. And the first time I ever hosted Weekend Edition Sunday, I asked our music guru, Bob Boylan, whether there was any good bands coming through town who I could do a segment on. And he said, oh, yeah, there's this great electronica duo, blah, 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 blah. They're called Justice. And he did not realize the great coincidence of me being NPR's Justice correspondent.
Look at that.
That is pretty great.
Justice. And so I began my piece about them by saying, you know, in my 3.5 years as NPR's Justice correspondent, I've never actually interviewed Justice until now. And
Aligned.
Isn't that nice?
And earlier we listened to the Ting Tings.
Yeah, the Ting Tings have been kind of my summer workout music. They're a British duo, a man and a woman, and I kind of think of them as like, I mean, if anyone from the B-52s is listening, they might be offended at my saying this, but I kind of think of them as like a 21st century B-52s.
I don't think the B-52s would be offended by that.
Well, because they just released an album of their own.
Yeah.
So I would think the B-52s would like to think of themselves as 21st century.
No, they
but
don't.
To my mind, you know, the Ting Tings, they have that kind of campy, really fun vibe, much like the B-52s, but they're very, like, you know, of the moment. In fact, that song, That's Not My Name, one of my favorite things about it is it begins with the sound of a jump rope swishing through the air.
See, Ari, what you don't know is that every time we have a guest on, we write to them and we say, hey, you can call the music for the night, and nobody ever calls the music for the night. You are the first person
to
say, this is the music
that
we want.
Even the musician.
Being on your show.
What?
That was the biggest reason for me being on your show, is that I get to pick the music.
We're not your personal playlist, Ari Shapiro.
I thought it would be a selling point
to
people.
Alright, well, you
even
win.
The musicians have ignored that request from us.
We play their music by default. We just assume. We assume. But we didn't know if you had your own music for us to play.
I am not a recorded artist.
Were you in any, like, high school musicals or anything that we could have found and embarrassed you terribly with?
I will answer that question off the record.
Okay. That was a good journalistic answer. Which brings us to, did you see, I can only assume you did, Keith Olbermann's speech? I don't know what to call it.
Yeah, you mean the one on Prop 8?
Yes.
The rant.
What I think is really interesting is that for years and years there has been a very strong presence on the right on cable news. And it is really only very recently that this strong cable news presence on the left has emerged, with Keith Olbermann and now Rachel Maddow, who has, you know, boosted MSNBC's ratings an incredible amount.
She's fantastic.
And, you know, it kind of surprises me that with 8 years of a conservative administration in the White House, that it took really until, like, you know, the last year or two for this kind of liberal alternative to Fox News to really make its presence and its voice felt on cable news.
So it's okay that he was pretty partisan on that.
Well, I think that's his role. I mean, I don't think he pretends to be unbiased in the same way that Bill O'Reilly doesn't pretend to be unbiased. They both have points of view that they put out there. I mean, you know, one of the things that I think is especially valuable about having MSNBC kind of take this leftward tilt is that it helps, I think, counteract the myth that Fox News is center and everything else is left of center. It kind of shows, well, no, you know, Fox News is right of center, MSNBC is left of center, and, you know, NPR is dead in the middle.
Do you sometimes want to just do what I will now call a verb, a Keith Olbermann, and just break out in a segment and say, Harvey Milk has relevance.
I value what Keith Olbermann does. I think perspectives and points of view are really important for the public discourse. You know, the editorial and op-ed pages are one of the first things I read in the newspaper in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's also an important role for, you know, the thing I do every day, and I'm really privileged to be able to do that. And so there's never been a time where I've thought, God, I just want to, you know, go out there and go on a rant about how I feel about this, because that's really not my role. And I, you know, I feel like there are people doing that on all sides of the political spectrum very effectively, and I really enjoy the role that I play. You know, I get to kind of be the storyteller and the narrator. And the fact is, I haven't done stories about gay marriage because I do have a personal stake in it. And even though I think I could do those stories from a fair, unbiased perspective, just the appearance of bias is enough that, you know, there are plenty of other stories for me to do.
Right.
And so, you know, that's the role I play.
We want you to do then your thing right now, because we're here in Vermont. Oh, and Becca's a little sick tonight, so sorry about the coughing.
Sorry, Becca. You have chicken soup?
I did have chicken soup today.
Good. With some matzo balls or not?
No, matzo balls.
All right.
Sorry.
Anyway, so we're up here in Vermont. They called Vermont for Obama the day before Election Day and put it there on the map. So nobody really listened to us, and we don't really have a good perspective of the country. And we're okay with that. We're on our lofty perch. So we're not seeing what our guests each week are seeing out there in the world.
Right.
So we want to hear some of what you're seeing in terms of, particularly in terms of some of the emotions you're seeing. We've been talking the last couple of weeks about what makes a leader and whether or not the LGBT community currently has. We heard this great report on NPR last week. I think it was actually on Morning Edition about Harvey Milk.
Yeah, my friend Etta Ulubi did that. Who you should also have on the show. She's terrific.
Okay. Will you tell her?
I'll tell her.
Okay.
Tell her that we're real people. We're not spam.
People know that radio people are real people.
Okay. I mean, I have to tell you not to boost you up, although we enjoy doing that. You opened the floodgates for us. You gave us street cred.
Really?
All these people who said, well, not so much, now are saying, oh, yes, I'll absolutely be on your show. So we're.
Did you tell them I was someone else?
No. We are exploiting the NPR good name.
Well, more power to you. NPR and Vermont have a long-standing relationship.
Look at that.
Now
I feel like we're doing our part.
We are. We're trying.
So anyway, so the report was still fantastic because we talk weekly about Harvey Milk is absolutely my hero. And the report was in some ways kind of devastating for me to hear that, particularly with youth, he perhaps doesn't have that much relevance, which brings us to, do you see a leader out there, and do we need one?
The short answer, no, and yes.
Any suggestions?
You know, one of the problems about gay history is that, you know, people in most minority groups, as you well know, are raised by parents of the same minority group.
Right.
And so there is a handing down of the history and the myths and the icons and the heroes that just doesn't happen in the gay community. I mean, I remember, you know, I came out when I was 16, and I went to this gay youth group in Portland, Oregon, and that's where I learned what Stonewall was. I'd never even heard of Stonewall.
Right.
So it's sad but not surprising to me that a lot of young gay people today don't know who Harvey Milk was, because, you know, aside from now Gus Van Sant's great new movie, what opportunity do they have to learn about him?
Have you seen it already?
No, you know what? Actually, I was invited to a showing, but it was last week when I was hosting Morning Edition, when my bedtime is 6 p.m., so I can wake up at 2 a.m.
Oh, my
gosh. So I wasn't able to go to the advanced showing, but I'm going to see it when it comes out in theaters.
Have you heard good things?
Oh, yeah.
I'm really nervous.
He said he just wept.
Okay, good.
In a good way?
And also, Gus Van Sant is a Portlander, so, you know.
You guys stick together.
You know, a strong tie to him and his films and his work. So I look forward to seeing the movie, but I haven't yet. But, you know, in answer to your question about a gay leader, yes, America needs one. No, I don't know where that's going to come from. And, you know, no, I don't think that any of the mainstream gay groups have really succeeded at staking that position and commanding the kind of urgency and credibility and respectability that, you know, such a leader would have to command.
So, I mean, because you interact with, in your role, as it kind of annoys me that it says justice correspondent, because you do so much more guest hosting than that, and
okay.
I don't know. I think you're bigger than...
I cover injustice from time to time.
You do a
but
lot more
than
that.
I kind of like the title. I feel like it's a bit of a kind of, I don't know, superhero sort of...
Oh, no, they're, you know, their powers.
Intelligence correspondent has the same kind of thing going for her. She's the intelligence correspondent, you know.
That's pretty cool, too.
That is really cool.
So, in your interactions with leaders, what qualities do you think that the gay community really needs right now in a leader for someone to step forward?
I mean, you look at any great leader, it doesn't have to be a gay role model. You look at somebody like Barack Obama, what made him so charismatic, so compelling. I mean, why were people so much more enthusiastic about him than they were about John Kerry and Al Gore? It wasn't just because of their policy positions. It was because of the desire people had to listen and follow what he was saying and the enthusiasm that he created. I mean, you know, I think we need to have somebody who somehow can stop the infighting in the gay community, stop the civil war and the turf battles, and you know, galvanize people, bring them together in a way that, frankly, in my entire life, I've never seen gay people rally over anything the way they've rallied around Prop 8 in the last week or two.
And with some really cool signs.
Yeah. No more Mr. Nice Gay.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
If you ban our weddings, we'll stop planning yours.
That's a good one. There's one, I have to tell you, my favorite one that I saw online today was, you're making Ellen sad.
Oh.
Yeah. And I just thought that was fantastic, because I think that actually will change some behavior.
Yeah.
I think some people...
Well, you know, the other thing is, I don't think you can overstate the importance of just having visible role models.
Right.
People like Ellen DeGeneres, you know, people like Rachel Maddow, people who, you know, folks in middle America can turn on the TV every night and get to know somebody who happens to be gay and get to know them on the basis of something other than solely their sexual orientation.
Right.
You know, when I came out, this was in the mid-90s, it wasn't that long ago, I just assumed that every gay person had to grow up to be a florist or a hairstylist.
Yes.
Not that there is anything wrong with being a florist or a hairstylist.
Not at all.
But obviously, gay people can do whatever they want to do. And not very long ago, there were no images of that in mainstream society. And I think just kind of having people out there doing an enormous range of things and being gay, you just can't overstate the significance of the impact that that can have.
Yeah, the only gay person that I truly recall seeing at that time was Matt on Melrose Place.
Yeah.
And he wasn't allowed to kiss.
Well, there was also... The Real World.
Oh.
That was a big,
groundbreaking
show.
That was huge.
Yeah.
I remember Norman. I remember that first season of The Real World. But the news this morning, that as we have gathered it, was that on Obama's website, President-elect Obama's website, he articulates an 8-point plan about how he's going to address LGBT civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a... I mean, it's fantastic.
This is on change.gov?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And passage of the Matthew Shepard Hate Crimes Act, gender inclusive, and I mean, tons of different things, which is just fantastic. And yet it makes me nervous.
How so?
I get nervous just because I mean, I was not a voting age when Clinton took office. But I remember how strongly he came out of the gate and said he was going to get rid of the ban on gays in the military. And that's really where Don't Ask, Don't Tell came from.
Yeah, well, I mean...
So I get nervous.
You know, I'm not predicting the future.
Right.
One big difference between...
You can, Ari.
...Clinton coming in and Obama coming in is that there are 58 now, you know, potentially 59 or 60 since there are still two undecided races. There are at least 58 Democrats in the Senate, and maybe not every one of them is going to vote for every one of Barack Obama's policies, but he's going to have a much easier time accomplishing most of his agenda than President Clinton had. I mean, the other thing is, when it comes specifically to Don't Ask, Don't Tell and gays in the military, a lot has changed in the last 16 years. I mean, just last week, maybe it was this week, more than 100 retired military officials, many of whom had opposed repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, signed a letter in support of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I really think, you know, it's just a matter of time until that changes. I mean, just looking at the rhetoric that you hear on Capitol Hill, even from many Republicans, I don't think Don't Ask, Don't Tell is long for this world.
Ari Shapiro, if you were telling me not to worry, I'm good.
As I say, I can't read the future, but I don't want you to worry.
Okay.
I want you to sleep soundly.
That's great.
You're gonna be fine tonight.
I'm going to sleep like a rock.
She's pretty drugged out right now, Ariana, cold medicine.
Yeah, but I've got to say, I've definitely seen a lot more people coming out and just living their lives more visibly lately in my day-to-day life.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I think so. In the last couple of years, I feel like it's just become more acceptable to come out doing whatever.
Yeah. It's funny. I will occasionally get an email from a listener who maybe has read about me someplace or, you know, seen me quoted in a gay publication and say, you know, it's so great that you're kind of out there and gay and doing your thing. And to me, it was never a question. It was just kind of obvious. It never felt like I was making a decision to kind of be an out journalist. I was just, you know, I've been out since I was 16 and I made a decision to be a journalist.
And that's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
But it's remarkable in its own right.
Well, you know, it's a testament to my family and society and the community I was raised in and, you know, the environment that allowed me to be a comfortable, reasonably well-adjusted gay teenager. That environment just really didn't exist very many years before I came of age.
Right.
Well, last year I was teaching Sunday school and I had a 10-year-old girl come out.
Wow.
10 years old.
Although
and she
Ari,
felt comfortable coming out in a church environment, which was pretty impressive, I thought.
But you realize, Becca, Ari just articulated our dream that we said on the first show.
What dream is that?
Of just someone writing us and saying that.
Yeah.
Well, whether they've written or not yet, I'm sure someone is listening.
We said that's the day that we go off the air, so we just have visions of people writing in and saying, oh, yes, we're gay, get off the air. But that hasn't happened yet. We anticipate that happening. So you were in New York recently.
Yeah, I was in New York last weekend.
And how was that?
It was great. I was there for the Out 100 party. And it was, I realize this makes me sound like a provincial small town kid.
Bring it on.
It was the most fabulous party I've ever been to in my life. It was amazing.
There were a lot I saw pictures online. There were a lot of people there.
There were a lot of people there. We have fancy parties in Washington, but they're rather buttoned up.
Right.
This one was pretty awesome.
No, I can tell you that when I was a junior at NYU, I was told, because I was a journalism major at the time, before I switched to medieval studies, and it was an easy transition, oddly, the journalism department said, you have to go get an internship somewhere. You need to do some sort of internship at a magazine or newspaper or some press. So I went to Out Magazine, and I walked over to I think it was on Green Street. I don't know if it still is. And I said, hey, do you have any openings for an intern? And so they made me an intern. And, of course, I thought, well, I'm going to write editorials now. But apparently it doesn't work like that. And I interned for the events planning.
Oh, fun.
So I was stuffing gift bags, and it was Out Magazine can throw a party.
They sure can.
So there were some interns who were working their butts off so you could have a good party.
There you go. That's
Thanks
good.
To all those interns, if any of them are listening.
But yes. they can grow up. Yeah, they can grow up to have a show on a local access.
You know, one of the funniest things about the party was that I ran into a guy who went to my high school 4 years before I did. And we didn't know each other because we were 4 years apart, but he recognized me because he knew my older brother and thought I just looked so much like him. He said, are you Dan Shapiro? And I said, no, I'm Ari Shapiro. And he said, oh my God, did you go to anyway. So
that's weird.
So we had this crazy connection. We were both in the Out 100 this year.
Oh,
and
wow.
We ended up reminiscing about all the teachers who we knew were gay, but no one else knew were gay, and they weren't out back in the 90s. You know, and now our high school has a gay straight alliance, and it's just everything is completely different.
Yes. When you wrote that, I was telling Ari this online. It inspired me to go back to my high school and ask some questions about whether or not they have a gay straight alliance.
And do they?
No. And there was a chuckle.
Wow.
So I'm going to...
Oh, dear.
It was actually one of the highlights of my professional career was going back to my high school when I was doing a lot more trainings on LGBT issues and doing an LGBT 101 workshop there at the high school. And I was, you know, I'd done hundreds of these and gone around and toured around and done all these different things. But I got totally choked up when I went to this high school because, oh, there was the locker where someone said something mean. And I know.
Somebody said something mean.
Someone said, whatever. Uh-oh. I'm sure he's a really nice guy now.
I think something that has really changed the landscape, when I was in high school, you know, one big roadblock to starting something like a Gay-Straight Alliance was getting school permission to advertise in the halls, because if you didn't put up a poster, nobody knew it was happening.
Absolutely.
And now that there's Facebook, I really think students have a lot more freedom to create those kinds of things and sort of circumvent the, you know, bureaucratic system.
Right,
absolutely.
But actually, Facebook also makes it more visible to people who you might not want to know. I mean, that kind of puts it out there. Students can't have, like, a secret group, you know,
right,
that is just meeting at lunchtime without anybody really noticing. It's on your list of groups, and anybody who wants to be your friend will see it. So that's interesting, too.
Yeah, this whole cyber culture was not there when
But
we
people
were
don't seem
school.
To hesitate because of that, where I see people our age and older wouldn't want that.
Right.
Right.
Right. So you had an amazing time at the Out 100 party. Where was it? Where was it?
It was at a place called Gotham Hall at 36th and Broadway, and I don't know what the space was originally intended for, but it's just this huge, cavernous, you know, elegant, circular space with towering ceilings, and a big stage up in front where there were performers from Cirque du Soleil, and Patti LaBelle reunited with her backup singers for the first time in 30 years.
Oh, my God.
They just recorded a new album, and this was their first reunion performance. They were amazing. They brought down the house. Sam Sparrow performed. You know, he has the big single Black and Gold.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
Padma Lakshmi was there presenting an award. I mean, it was just...
Just so enjoyable.
Yeah, it was great. It was really, really an incredible
And they don't rank the people, right? It's just there's 100 people.
No, but somebody was going around introducing himself as 98 all evening. But I think that was just his own self-conception.
All right. We also heard, or read... Becca read, right, about some crazy running?
What?
Doesn't Ari Shapiro do some crazy running?
Parkour.
Oh, yeah, I do parkour. I'm a little bit addicted to it.
That just means you're like ADHD.
It is.
With focus, though.
It's amazing.
Channeling the hyperactivity.
I've never even heard of it.
Well,
yeah, he's
going to,
like, jump over walls.
Casino Royale, the opening chase sequence in Casino Royale is parkour. And it's sort of, you know, in the same way that if you think of the fight or flight instinct.
Okay.
If martial arts are about mastering fight, parkour is about mastering flight.
Right,
and
so he's
it's about
running away very efficiently.
What did you say?
Running away very efficiently.
Exactly. Over walls, from rooftop to rooftop, scaling buildings, vaulting over fences, and it's all about flow and momentum and fluidity of motion.
Ari Shapiro, I feel like you've sustained an injury doing this.
No, you know, I scraped my shin.
He's a
ankle,
superhero. He doesn't get hurt.
Right. He's justice.
Like
he's justice.
That's right. I'm the justice correspondent.
You are the you have the cape, and it flows behind you as you do this activity that I've never heard.
You need to get a phone booth for your apartment or
there
house.
There are no more phone booths. What are you talking about? Does Vermont still have phone booths, too?
No,
phone
but for the costume change.
Right.
You know, like a cell tower isn't really
I'm totally freaked out that my students are doing this thing.
It's really big on college campuses. But you shouldn't
what,
be
parkour?
Freaked out. It is an incredible discipline, is what people call
all
it.
Right.
And you know, you start small and you start low and you work your way up, and there are very basic moves that anybody can practice. I mean, you know, one move is called the precision jump. So you take like a sidewalk curb and you stand 3 feet away and you jump and you try to land perfectly right on the curb. And then you jump from a little farther, and then you pick something a little higher, and then the next thing you know, you're jumping up on a railing and balancing there.
Yeah, I'm actually not going to do that.
Okay. That's all right.
I'm going to stick to my cardio kickboxing here in Brattleboro.
But that's will you come up here too. and do some parkour?
Totally.
That would be awesome.
That would be fantastic. So what, I mean, in addition to just listening to you daily, are there any stories that you're doing coming up that you're really excited about?
Oh, you know, we're constantly focusing on the transition, the Bush to Obama transition on every new appointee and what's going to happen at the Justice Department, because there has been so much turmoil there in the last couple of years.
Has
actually,
there?
Actually, there's one story I heard about that I just heard about this last night.
Okay.
That I'm really excited about doing, and I'll tell you as long as you promise not to go do it ahead of me.
Okay.
Yeah, Ari, we don't break stories here on this show.
Well, there are these murals all throughout the Justice Department.
Okay.
And they were painted by WPA artists, you know, given work during the Depression. And there is one mural over the stairwell that leads up to the library. And it almost was not hung up because it was so controversial. And the mural shows a cowering black man on the steps of a courthouse and a lynch mob with torches and a judge standing between the two holding back the mob.
Wait, why is that still there?
All of these murals are still up there. It's an anti-lynching mural. And this was hung above the steps going up to the library.
I feel like PBS did a special on those murals at some point.
Well, this one was hung above the steps going up to the library so that every lawyer going to research a legal brief in the library would have a reminder that this is who he's supposed to be. This is the role that he's supposed to play, holding back the unruly mob from the person who cannot defend him.
Huh.
But this anti-lynching message was so controversial in the 30s that it almost was not hung, you know, put up in the Justice Department.
We're there with you, Ari.
Sorry,
we're there with you.
Bad
fight or flight, Ari. Keep going.
Anyway, and the timing of this story is great because, of course, we're about to see the first African-American attorney general nominated to the post, which would be Eric Holder. We learned this week that Obama intends to tap him. So, anyway, that's a story I'm really excited about doing. And I was just talking to NPR's photo editor, because now, of course, we have this website that gives us all kinds of capabilities doing visual stuff, about putting together a great slideshow to accompany the story on the radio. So keep your ears open.
We are going to keep our ears open for that. You've done an amazing job guest hosting the past couple weeks.
Thanks a lot.
It's been very enjoyable listening on the way to workout. I'm Ari Shapiro.
Yeah, it's a fun change of pace, although it is a rough schedule, I got to tell you. I don't know how Steve and Renee wake up at 2 every morning.
2 in the morning.
That is
Actually,
rough.
Steve is waking up at 2. Renee's in Los Angeles. She's waking up at 11 p.m.
Oh, how do you go to sleep at 6?
Well, on Sunday night, it's really hard. And then you're so exhausted Monday that it's really easy.
Oh, well, there you go.
For the week, you're on the schedule.
Well, Ari Shapiro, you have given us a street cred that I almost don't feel like we deserve. But we're
going to
take it. We're going to take it. And it really helps me with my students, too. I think the Carl Castle on my voicemail got me through a year. And this
I can't compare to Carl Castle.
And yet, here you are. Because this is a person-to-person. So you got to set up the next song for us, because I feel like you picked a song that I just am not going to be able to say the name of it right, and I'm going to feel really stupid.
Okay, the song's called Autrefois.
You already know what I'm going to say. There you go.
And this is a band that I have a really close relationship with, because one of the first stories I ever did for NPR when I was but a wee tyke was a profile of this band and why it was taking them so long to come out with their second album. They're a band from my hometown of Portland, Oregon. They're called Pink Martini. And in working on the story and in the years since, I've become really good friends with the band leader, who's the pianist, the lead singer, China Forbes, the pianist's name is Thomas Lauderdale. And so we've become very close. You know, because this was the first story I did so many years ago, I now find that story virtually unlistenable, but I still listen to this band's albums all the time.
Oh.
And this is, I like this song because it's got kind of a trip-hop beat to it. It's kind of moody and introspective and one of my favorite songs.
Well, that's gonna get us through our night now. Ari Shapiro, you have been just astronomically generous with your time, and we just adore having you on, and hope you can call back another night.
Thanks, I'd love to, and Becca, I hope you feel better soon.
Well, thank you very much. I hope you come on sometime when I'm a little less high and a little more with it, because I have so many questions I'd love to ask you, but
it's
I'm just...
deal.
Yeah.
Ari, be careful with the whole running around.
I will be careful.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to queue up Pink Martini right now. Thank you, Ari Shapiro.
All right, have a good night, you guys.
All right, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Earlier this year, on February 18th, swimming legend and sports journalist Diana Nyad called in. Now, what we didn't tell you that night was that Diana had other commitments and was on a pretty tight time frame. Becca and I were prepared to talk with her for about 10 minutes or less and then release her back into her busy schedule. But we got so caught up and the three of us had such a great time chatting that we just didn't want to stop the interview. Take a listen.
This show is So Gay is proud and thrilled to welcome journalist and swimming icon. You are an icon. Diana Nyad to this week's show. In addition to her weekly sports pieces on NPR, Diana recently launched a fitness movement for women over 40, which we are going to talk about, bravabody.com, to empower women towards everyday well-being. Oh, and she is the world record holder for the longest swim in history, 102.5 freaking miles. Not meters, miles. 102.5 miles, Diana.
That's right.
Okay.
Why?
No, we're getting to that.
Okay.
Hold on.
Okay.
We're going to get to that. She was also recently named to Out Magazine's 100 People Who Contributed Most to American Culture for 2008. And listeners, don't tell our other Out 100ers this, but Diana Nyad's picture was the coolest photograph of all of the photographs.
Yes.
It was by far the coolest photograph. And with that, Diana Nyad, welcome to this show, So Gay, with Ken and Becca.
Thank you so much. Ken, Becca, it is my pleasure. And how about that Out photograph? I would never, you know, I'm no, like, raving beauty. I would never say, oh, you got to see my photo. Here's my, but that one?
That one is,
I will take an enlarged blow up and throw it on my living room wall. It was that hot.
It's fantastic.
It's very good.
When you saw it for the first time, were you like, oh, my God.
Yeah, blown away. Well, first of all, I can only imagine how large the industrial size airbrush was that they used.
Oh, please.
No, I mean,
you're a swimmer. Your skin is well hydrated.
Yeah, it was hydrated, but not like that. They blew off about 30 years for me on that. And also, you know, it's funny because I will occasionally wear like a short mini skirt or boots. That's why I like Pink so much, and I asked for some Pink music tonight. She's hot, she's bold, she's strong, she's creative. So I'll do that, but I don't like the whole top bit. Like, they took
right.
me all the Out photographs this year were going to be based on 1930s glamour in Hollywood, and I was picturing, oh, strapless gowns, you know, over-the-shoulder gowns, and it's just not me. And then the art director calls me the day before, and he said, how about we do something like a Greta Garbo men's suit? I said, now we're talking.
That is you. It's a fantastic photo. That's a keeper.
Thank you. I love it.
So 102.5 miles.
Yeah, don't forget the 0.5 because, you know, 102, anybody can do.
Well, I did 102 yesterday, but it was the 0.5. There was no way.
No, when you get to 102 and then you look at that shore and it's another 0.5 friggin' miles away, you say, I can't make it. Not another 0.5. Don't give me another 0.5. But, you know, somehow I caught a lucky current and I got that last half mile in.
You made it.
I made it.
You made it. All right, you want to talk some LGBT news with us?
Sure.
So I did a little research because I'm trying to be more topical with our guests and not throw random topics. So I was doing a lot of research on the intersection between LGBT identity and athletics. And it's something that I'm pretty darn passionate about and wanted to talk with you a little bit about that, if you're okay with it.
Okay. Yeah.
So this was the 10th anniversary of Amélie Mauresmo. I'm a huge tennis addict, Diana.
Okay.
I'm a crazy tennis addict. So this was the 10th anniversary of Amélie Mauresmo, who's an amazing French tennis player. She came out at the Australian Open 10 years ago, and they interviewed Billie Jean King about it. And one of the things that Billie Jean King said is, we need straight people, this is a quote, we need straight people, particularly in the male arena, to support the gay guys. They have to. And if they stand up for us, that's how we gain acceptance. We need our friends, our brothers and sisters, especially if they have influence. And that, I wanted to talk about that a little bit, because there is no small lack of out women in sports, but the number of out men, particularly in team sports, is pretty small. What's that about, Diana?
Oh, it's close to zero. I mean, you know, well, now you're bringing up a whole gamut of things here. So let's start.
Let's start.
Back a little bit before we go to men and team sports. Let's go to Amélie Mauresmo.
Oh.
Okay. Now, you know, unfortunately, what drives sports, what drives the money in sports, is the young male sports fan.
Right.
You know, call it crazy. You know, I wouldn't think that would be the tennis audience, but it's still, that's what brings in advertising dollars. That's what brings in television contracts. And I'm telling you, I used to work for Fox Sports, which is sort of the playground of young male sports fans. And they would stand around watching, you know, television screens, and when someone, you know, bulky and, shall we say, more masculine looking, like a Serena Williams would come on, they would go, oh, my God, you know, I just... this isn't worth watching. Whereas, you know, if someone like an Anna Ivanovich came on, who's, you know, very femmy and plays up her straight lifestyle.
And marketable.
Into it, and they want to watch the sport. Whereas Amélie Mauresmo, I mean, call me crazy. Like you said, Ken, you're a tennis fan. To me, this is a very classically attractive woman.
Oh, gosh. Oh, yeah.
I mean, she's got, you know, beautiful, you know, jawline and eye color and, you know, she wears a beautiful French pleated skirt with the best of them, but she's gay.
Right.
And so, you know, if you listen to male talk radio, which is, you know, guy talk all day long, they hate her. It's almost to the point of hatred. They hate this woman. They don't care whether she's got a great sliced backhand. They don't care whether, you know, she won the Australian Open. They hate her just because she's not into guys sexually.
Right.
And it's obvious. You know, it's obvious out there. So tell me something. If Amélie Mauresmo has trouble, you know, in terms of selling herself, you know, as an endorsement, you know, queen, what is a guy who's playing in the NBA or the NFL or the NHL, what's he going to do if he's gay? Like, name me one right now.
Right.
You know, if we say, what do we say, 10% of the population? And, you know, the three of us know that it's higher than that if you talk about, you know, the full gamut of gay people in our society. Well, you know, you're telling me in the National Basketball Association there isn't one gay individual? Well, of course that's bull.
Right.
They are, but they're scared to death. They're scared what, you know, how they would be maligned in their locker room, how their story would take away from the team's focus during the year, that, you know, every press person would be around just pressing on that story, and they're scared that, you know, they're even in their private lives, that their families won't accept them. So you just can't tell me that in the NFL and in men's tennis and in, you know, men's golf and in all those men's sports, there aren't just a dabbling, just a few gay guys. Of course there are, but they're living in utter fear and they cannot come out.
I can't believe the team sports. I'm not making any excuses for team sports, but I'm just so floored about men's tennis. There was an article, I think it was a couple months ago in Out Magazine, about Francisco Rodriguez, who professional man retired. I think he's retired now. Men's tennis player who came out, and they interviewed Justin Gimelstob, who is not a friend to really anyone, either gay or women. And Justin Gimelstob said, and I jotted it down, I think that they're, quote, I think there's 100% chance that a player who comes out would be an outcast and wouldn't be signing a deal for Viagra or Trojans. Good luck finding top players to talk about this. I just was so floored by that because, all right, there's team sports, but in men's tennis, it struck me as ridiculous.
I know, I agree, but still, you know, look at what just happened to Michael Phelps, okay?
Right.
I know that picture, you know, it was a tough picture. You know, it would be a lot different if Michael Phelps, honestly, was, you know, in the privacy of his own apartment with one great friend and they were smoking a little tiny joint. You know, then people, you know, could say a little bit like, hey, you know, he's a normal human being. He's not some big pothead, and he's not, you know, throwing away his life to drugs. Of course not. He's a 23-year-old who may occasionally drink a couple of beers, smoke a little pot, but unfortunately he was smoking like the biggest bong in the Western planet, on the Western world. And, you know, and that picture was just horrible to see. That beautiful lung capacity, you know, was being geared toward this giant 4-foot bong. So that wasn't a good image, but...
That was not a 1930s Greta Garbo image.
No. There you go. And I just can't imagine how he is cringing and regretting you know, that he didn't have the foresight to know just how famous he is at this moment. And no matter where he is, some jerk with a cell phone can capture his picture. So, you know, he's learned a big lesson in that. But my point is, to try to get it back to the gay issue, is that for some reason, we expect, you know, we hear about our actors and our, you know, and people in other walks of life, that we learn about them that, oh, they smoked a joint last night. Oh, they, you know, they had a homosexual or a bisexual relationship in college, or they are gay or whatever. It's like, oh, well, they're creative and they're allowed to do all that. But my God, if you're an athlete, look at Alex Rodriguez. To me, this is just, it's preposterous that we think now Alex Rodriguez must not be a great baseball player because he took some performance-enhancing drugs for a couple of years. I'm not saying that I condone that entirely, but it's the way of the athletic world. And so is homosexuality to a degree. So is pot smoking to a degree. But athletes are held to this, you know, apple pie, whole milk standard that is just not of the real world.
No.
Young people smoke a little pot. Young people, you know, come into their sexuality early on in life. And, you know, we hold them up as to say, that's not being a great athlete. You know, you can't be gay and be a great athlete. That's just not, you know, Mickey Mantle. That's not Joe Montana. It's not right. And it's crazy, whether it's tennis or football. It's crazy. But unfortunately, the public has this apple pie image. And, you know, we tarnish it all the time.
Even when they win a gold medal, like Matthew Mitchum, who struggled to find a sponsorship deal, which was just remarkable.
Well, forget about Matthew. Let's take Greg Louganis.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you read his book. I you know, did the review for it for the L.A. Times. And, you know, Greg Louganis is a beautiful man. He's, you know, is still the greatest diver in the history of the sport, male or female. And, you know, he suffered and suffered. You would think at that level, you know, you could just write your own ticket.
It's right.
Greg Louganis, and, you know, you're now on to your X number of gold medals, and you're, you know, an icon not only of the sport but of male beauty. You know, nobody looked more beautiful careening through the air gracefully than Greg Louganis, but he knew that he just couldn't stand up as Martina could, although she lost a lot of endorsements too,
right.
But he couldn't stand up even at his prime and say, go take a hike, I'm gay. And, you know, you can't do anything about it. You can't keep me from winning the next gold medal. Maybe you'll keep me from an endorsement or two, but you can't keep me from being on the cover of Sports Illustrated. I'm just too good. I'm going to write my own ticket. He couldn't do it. You know, and even the women can't do it. Moresmo can't do it. And Martina, I admire her for how far she's gone with it. But the truth is, you know, when you look down the list of her endorsements, you know, she has definitely suffered for it, too.
Right. Although I did like that Billie Jean King in this article said that while she lost a lot of endorsements, now she actually gets endorsements for being gay. Although I don't know how many.
Yeah, well, it's not the same as, you know, someone who would be considered straight and a raving heterosexual beauty, believe me, and Billie Jean would be the first one to tell you that. It's just that she can afford at this point.
Right.
Just, you know, be who she is. But let's look back. You know, she felt she couldn't afford that when she was in her 20s, 30s, and even 40s.
I'm having such a flashback, which is not the direction I wanted to go with this, to in that Australian Open final when Martina Hingis called Moresmo half a man, and you just cringed. You just thought, oh my gosh, this is two women, and this is, it just was terrible. And I
missed that.
Oh yeah, 1999.
But let me, you know, this sounds a little sideways, you guys, but still. I was listening to Bill Maher.
This whole show is sideways.
Yeah.
The show that Bill Maher did before he does his HBO thing now.
Yeah.
You know, where he'd have three or four really smart people and they would discuss things.
Oh, Politically Incorrect.
Okay, that's what it is. Politically Incorrect, which is a great show. And, you know, we think of Bill Maher as far, far left liberal. I just can't believe that he doesn't have a number of gay friends in his, you know, cachet of close people to him. But, you know, I remember, and I'm going to forget who it is right now, but some woman was on there. It might have been Lily Tomlin. I hate to say because I forget. But some woman was on there, a gay woman, and she said something about, you know, she and her girlfriend playing around with a dildo, okay? And Bill Maher just was taken aback. I mean, he stopped. He just waved his hand and said, stop talking. Stop. He said, wait a second. Wait a second. I am very confused. Now, you're telling me that gay women, some of them, play around with dildos? He said, gay women hate men, and they hate penises, and they don't want to have anything to do with heterosexual sex. So why in the world would they play around with penises? And I thought, you know what? If intelligent left-wing Bill Maher has such a twisted misconception of what, you know, sexuality is and what homosexuality is, and, you know, he's got it in this little compartmentalized box.
Absolutely.
And Martina Hingis, you know, not quite as smart as Bill Maher.
No.
She's got a twisted view of what homosexuality is, too.
Yeah, I mean, Martina Hingis did not graduate from my high school. Bill Maher, he did. That's the only famous graduate we have.
He did?
Okay. He did, yeah.
You're going to have this little dildo talk with him sometime, Ken.
You know, he hasn't called me in so long, Diana. It's really sad.
I knew we were going to be talking about the facts of life.
So the other story, which I thought was very interesting and perhaps dovetails nicely into bravabody.com, there was an article I was checking out. This is perhaps going in the wrong direction. I was checking out outsports.com, which I had never looked at before. I've seen a lot of, there's a whole sports section on gay.com, but I never looked at outsports.com. And I was really, this is not my point in bringing it up. I was extraordinarily perturbed by the whole website. There were some good stories, but it was interspersed with this very sensationalist kind of, oh, and this soccer team drops their pants in between, some actual content of gay athletes. That's my rant about outsports.com. But on there, there was an article that said, finally, a straight man who's creeped out by Sports Illustrated's all-girls swimsuit issue. Jeff Perlman said, I just find the issue strange. The average Sports Illustrated reader is probably a male in his mid-40s. The average Sports Illustrated swimsuit model is a girl, usually 19, 20, 21, or 22 years old. They almost always have breathtaking faces with the awkward bodies of 14-year-old boys. And I thought that that was an interesting kind of body image thing to put out there for women. And it was nice to actually have a straight man say that. I don't know if you saw that at all or
you
saw
know,
the issue.
I didn't see that. I'm not familiar with outsports, but God knows, you know, all my life I've seen this Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. And, you know, taken offense at it. Not that I do take offense at, you know, women's pictures in the nude, men's pictures, for those particular publications where you go for that. But this is called Sports Illustrated. It's the revered weekly that puts on its cover, you know, I mean, people count. How many times has Derek Jeter been on the cover?
Right.
It's one of the emblems of his fame as an athlete and his great achievement. How many times did BJK make the cover? So when you know, we're asked to look at this, you know, 30 pages of beautiful beaches and, you know, young women, you know, in the nude, those guys, those middle-aged men, young men who want to see those pictures, they have so many places to see them. They have so many opportunities to go and pick up other magazines and other websites and whatnot to see them. Why do the rest of us who pick up SI because we truly passionately care about sports, you know, have to be subjected to this every February?
Right.
And again, it's not that I say I'm a prude, but I disagree with that guy. I don't think they have, you know, much of the modeling world, of course, is built around girls who have 14-year-old bodies with very, you know, no curves, no breasts, no nothing. But I don't think that's true of the Sports Illustrated models. I think they're very curvy and have a little more fat on them than the average anorexic model. So it's a little bit of an aside, but I disagree with that analysis of their bodies. But it's just, for me, it's the wrong place, but I've given up. Whether it's National Public Radio or ABC Sports or Good Morning America, I've done every show there is, lambasting Sports Illustrated for that issue, but it's a big selling issue, and they're never going to change it. So I've given up on it. But it's the wrong place for those particular photos.
In my fantasy world, you made an appearance on this show and lambasted Sports Illustrated, and that made all the difference.
There we go.
We're going to make the papers
it's
tomorrow.
It's a resume builder for Diana Nyad.
Yeah,
so tell it.
Fantasy, it happened.
Oh, yeah. Tell everybody about bravabody.com. I was surfing around it today, and it's just fantastic.
Well, it's a direct connection to what we were just talking about. My best friend is named Bonnie Stoll, and she and I started Brava Body a couple of years ago. And the way why we started it was what we were about to go on a vacation. We're going to go with a bunch of women about our age. I'm 59 now, so this is when I was like 57. Bonnie's a couple of years younger. We're in good shape. You know, we don't look like we did when we were 25, but we look pretty darn good. So we're going to go down to Machu Picchu, hike that thing. Then we're going to go kayaking along the coast of Mexico, see some whales. It's pretty intense, you know. And then we're going to go to a resort, you know, sort of beach hotel and hang around by the pool for a couple of days. So our group of friends, a few of them call as we're getting ready and getting in shape for this trip, and they say, you know, I love the hike, love the Machu Picchu, love the kayaking. I'm getting my upper body and, you know, ready for that. But I will never, ever appear in public in a bathing suit again. So I'm not going on the resort beach vacation part. And Bonnie and I were like, what the
heck?
What has happened? Has it really come to this? That, you know, we are so fixated on perfection of body. Women in this culture, you know, it starts with anorexia and bulimia at 11 and 12, just fixation on body image. And I, you know, I'm vain. I like to look good in my clothes and my jeans when I go out at night. But what I'm concerned about, what I'm fixated about for my body is that I enjoy this beautiful planet of ours, that I enjoy the kids that are in my life, that I have energy. I don't have to go get the guy next door to put the water bottle on the dispenser in my kitchen, because I am strong enough and agile enough to hoist it up in the air and put it on there myself.
102.5 miles.
Yeah, there you go. I did that. But, I mean, that's 30 years ago.
Right.
Today, it is exactly 30 years ago that I did that swim. So now today it's 2009. I'm 59 years old, and I'm competent, and I'm confident in my body. I walk down the sidewalk like I own it. And I want to impart that. That's why we chose the word brava.
Right.
And good for you. Maybe you're not what you used to be, but get out there and be competent and confident and enjoy your life. Take control of your life, because you have control of it physically. You're going to have control of it emotionally and in your career and your relationships, and be able to handle your heartache better and cope with the disasters in your life. You're going to soar because that temple of yours is in shape. So that's why we called it Brava Body.
I am sitting up straighter now, and I realize that I'm not your demographic, but just even hearing that, I'm sitting up a little bit
Ken's
straighter
Ken's got his
right
pep
now.
Talk for the night.
That's great. Excellent. And what kind of responses are you? I just can imagine you're getting the most incredible responses.
You know, we are, and we sit, Bonnie and I cry. I mean, we are ex-world-class athletes. Bonnie was as well as I was. And, you know, we still train people for the Ironman in Hawaii, you know, strong young bodies. We do all that. But the truth is, what makes us cry is a woman is 280 pounds. She writes to us that she is so ashamed of herself that she doesn't even want to look herself in the mirror. She takes her son to school, and she slumps over her steering wheel and sobs when she leaves him off, because she knows he's so ashamed of her, because the kids at school are talking about how his mother is so darn fat. And she writes us, and after working with us for 6 weeks, I'm not saying that we take 100 pounds off people, but we're realistic. We get people going. And, you know, she'll write us back and say, oh, my God, you guys, I've lost 20 pounds. I feel like maybe there's hope for me after all. Last night I got really mad at my husband, and I went out and got a giant-sized bag of Cheetos and a six-pack of Coke, and I ate and drank the whole damn thing. And we write her back and say, don't be so tough on yourself.
Yeah.
We do that kind of stuff, too. Go ahead. Just be realistic. But tomorrow, get up and go. Get back into it. You know, and so that's what moves us. And we've got a country of obesity. I'll tell you a little secret, and I just thought of this 2 days ago. So you're the first media people I'm telling.
Ooh.
Maybe I'm crazy, but...
Breaking news.
We love breaking news.
Yeah, here it is. Breaking news. It's happening on your show. In the next 8 years, I want to be assigned by the Obama administration as the fitness czar of America. I want to go around America to, you know, the AARP and cul-de-sacs and Blue Cross Blue Shield and schools, and do a program called Get Up and Go. This is a Brava Body, but of course, you know, it would be affected. And I want to get people, by the time Obama finishes his 8 years, because I'm going to assume it's going to be eight, not four, we're not only going to, he's going to help heal the economy and all the other, you know, desperate measures that are needed to take to get the society going again. I want to be the fitness czar, whereby at the end of these 8 years, people are going to look at America and say, you know what, they're not the obese people anymore.
Yeah.
Just like the Chinese doing Tai Chi, those Americans get up and they ride their bikes and they walk around the neighborhood and they do a few toe touches together. You know, the whole country's changing. That's what I want to do.
And everybody's walking a little bit straighter.
There
just standing up
straighter.
Straighter. Well, that too. We say every week we on the show, Diana, we talk about what is a leader and what can we actually do. We read so many LGBT news stories, and sometimes I perhaps get a little angry and depressed and feel a little helpless. And we say, well, what is actually making a difference? And it's just such a thrill to have you on the show, because you really are making a difference.
And you have so much good energy about it, too. It's just amazing that you're so motivated and excited.
It's just great. So we thank you just enormously for sharing that with us and with everyone listening out there. And folks should check out bravabody.com.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Becca.
Thank you.
Do you have one more minute, or do we need to go?
No, go. We got it.
You know, I was thinking when you said, I didn't realize that you did this on the show, talk about leadership and, you know, making a change. Well, you know, I think every anthropologist, Margaret Mead, et cetera, has said that change doesn't come on a global level. It comes on a very small neighborhood level. So, you know, on Halloween night, I was over at a friend's house, a gay man, and we were having a great little Halloween party, and we'd all go out and meet the kids. And so this Latino family comes up to the door, and we had a, you know, no to Prop 8, you know, huge sign out on the lawn. And this guy is like 22 years old. He's with his wife, who's about the same age, and they have a little baby they're pushing in the carriage, and she's got this really cute little costume on. And he says to me, you know, that no on 8, that really bothers me. I mean, it's just marriage is meant for a man and woman. I mean, you seem like such nice people, but it's just, it's wrong. I'm going to vote yes on 8. Mm-hmm. And so I stood outside with him, a couple of us did, for, you know, like an hour. And we talked to him. By the time he left, he said, you know, I never thought of it that way. Love is love. And so, you know, if people want to get together and, you know, like look at my daughter. If there were two men raising my daughter and giving her everything she needed in life, confidence and love and consistency, I wouldn't be against that. And I said, well, that's all it is.
That's all it is.
I don't know what you think being gay is, but it's just love. And that's what we got to accept. So, you know, if you can, on the one street in your neighborhood, on the one apartment floor in your building, if you can live the way you want to live, the way you think is right, and affect that small group of people that they're now going to embrace you. That guy was living in that neighborhood, and now he's going to go out and vote no on Prop 8 just because of a one little Halloween night conversation that changed his whole worldview around. And, you know, so I think leadership starts at a very small level, but it's crucial. It's to be applauded, and it's important.
It happens on that individual level. And that's what we struggle with, you know, especially with seeing milk and feeling like, oh, who's our leader and what do we coalesce around? And it really does happen in those individual conversations.
It does. It says, you know, be brave, be out at work, you know, be out in your neighborhood. And those people, believe me, it's a domino effect. They have their own work colleagues, and they have their own other family friends. And so they go out starting to tell stories. They say, hey, you know, there are two gay guys who live two doors down from me, and my God, they are the rocks of our neighborhood. They're the ones who started the neighborhood watch. There's the ones who, you know, who come over and babysit our kids when we have an emergency. I mean, they're the greatest people, and I just never knew any gay people before I met them. Well, you know, now their parents hear that story, and their colleagues at work hear that story, and they say, really? I really don't have any gay friends. I didn't realize that. I'd like to meet them, you know?
Yeah.
So it springboards, and all of a sudden, all of America is more open.
Right. And Ken is pretty tired of educating people, I think. And
yes.
We talk about that sometimes, how it's hard. You get backed into a corner sometimes. You know, someone hears that we have a radio show, and then they say, well, what's the name of your radio show? And then I always kind of pause. I'm like, oh, God, is this going to be a good conversation, a bad conversation? And it's sometimes hard to do that. It's sometimes hard to just jump right in.
Yeah.
But it's important to be those first few conversations and get out there.
It's important to be to be true to what you believe. And you don't have to be radical. You know, I'm not a radical at all. As a matter of fact, being gay is not, you know, the first thing I wear on my sleeve. It's not what I think when I wake up in the morning. Oh, I'm gay.
Right.
You know? That comes down the list a little bit. But I certainly am going to be everything I am, you know, every day of my life. And, you know, what more? What am I going to get to be 80 and 90 and die and look back and say, oh, I was afraid and, you know, I didn't support who, you know, what was really truly inside me? No.
No. Diana Knight, I cannot begin to tell you what an absolute treat it is to have you on our show. You are officially the fitness czar of the show.
I was going
so
to
gay.
Say that myself, indeed.
If you're okay with that.
Thank you.
But we'll share you with America.
There you go. I appreciate it. Put the word out. Maybe it'll happen.
That's what we're going to do. Diana Knight, we wish you all the best. Please, folks, check out bravabody.com. There is some amazing work going on there. And Diana Knight is in the center of it all. Thank you so much for calling into our show. We're going to play some more Pink for everybody, courtesy of Diana Knight.
There you go. Becca, Ken, honestly, it's been entirely my pleasure. You guys are great.
Thank you so much. Wishing you all the best, Diana.
Have a great night.
Cheers. Bye.
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 I'm lying here you done? I thought it would be fun. I can't stay on your life support. There's a shortage in the switch. I can't stay on your morphine, cause it's making me ill. I said I'd try to call the nurse again, but she's been a little bitch. I think
alright, I'll let you in on a little secret. Becca and I were flat out nervous on March 4th, 2009, when we welcomed Mayor E. Denise Simmons to our show. As we were about to speak with the first black lesbian mayor ever elected in the United States, and someone who's just an all-around inspiration, our goal was to not descend into our usual hijinks, which we almost pulled off, except at the end a little.
The Honorable Mayor E. Denise Simmons is a lifelong resident of Cambridge, Massachusetts, currently serving in her fourth term on the Cambridge City Council. She was voted by her fellow councilors to the mayoral position in January of 2008, making her the first African-American lesbian mayor in United States history. In the mayoral position, Mayor Simmons serves as chair of both the city council and the school committee. The top priorities of her platform are public safety, housing, economic development, education, and civic participation. Additionally, she was named to the Out 100 list of the most influential LGBT people in today's culture. It is a true, true honor to welcome the Honorable Mayor E. Denise Simmons to our show. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Ken.
First, we need to talk about the photo for the Out 100. If people have not seen this photo, you need to go online and see this photo, because it is Mayor Simmons in full Billie Holiday mode. What was that experience like for you in that photo?
It was really a lot of fun. My mother was a fan of Billie Holiday, as she was of Sarah Vaughan and Dinah Washington. But there was something about my mom in terms of the way she would wear her hair, and she didn't do a flower, but the way she would wear her hair that was very Billie Holiday-ish. And so it was very much like a tribute to her, as well as this wonderful singer, to have the opportunity to sort of channel Billie Holiday. It was a lot of fun. Great company, great people.
But the most important thing, did you get to keep the flower?
I did. I kept the flower for a good while.
Look at that.
Kind of petered out on me, and I said, I had to get my partner says, I think it's time to let it go, baby.
Oh, no, I would never. I would have laminated it. I would have kept that wherever you could. I would have vacuum sealed it in some way. And did you get to go to the Big Out 100 party?
Unfortunately, I didn't, and I was very disappointed, but I was asked to speak at the National League of Cities conference in Florida.
Oh, you and your priorities.
Yeah, you know, it's all about the job.
So it's about the job.
I was there. It was a wonderful experience. We got to talk about some of the great things that we're doing in Cambridge, and actually some of our young people are doing in Cambridge in terms of youth empowerment and outreach. And so it was a hard choice to make, but I'm glad I did it. I'm both glad I had an opportunity to participate in the magazine.
Well, can we talk about your job a little bit?
You can.
Okay.
I want to know about the number 77 bus.
Okay, Becca. All right. So Becca used to live in Cambridge. She wants to talk about
year.
That bus.
No.
Okay.
It's okay. I miss Cambridge an awful lot.
All right. We're going to move on to actual gay things.
You were doing a heck of a job.
Becca.
Okay.
Okay. Moving on to actual gay things. As I was doing some research and looking at Cambridge, and we talked a little bit about Cambridge last week with the gentleman on the commission who's going to be going cross country, which sounds like an amazing trip. I was thinking about this actually really terrible movie called The Trip, but it's this very silly gay movie called The Trip, in which there are these two characters, and the writer gay questions the activist gay about why the activist gay moved from Texas to California, asking something along the lines of, why not stay in Texas where they perhaps need you more? With Cambridge, the first U.S. city to allow gay marriage, are you ever tempted to just pack up and say, my work here is done. There are other places that need me.
No.
No. I was assuming no, but I wanted to check in.
You know, Cambridge is it's the city of my birth. I've been here all of my life. And although you can say, well, my work is done, the work is never done.
It's never done.
The more you do, there's always more to do. You know, yes, we have marriage equality, but there's still work to do around access for GLBT families to make sure that their kids of GLBT parents or GLBT young people feel safe in their schools. That work is never going to be
done. No.
And that's just at the beginning of it. We just had our second GLBT town meeting several months ago. And in those discussions, although we talked about, we were very happy that our police department has started to do GLBT awareness, we still have to work more when it comes to transgender issues.
Absolutely.
That's still an area that is misunderstood. And so when you talk about is the work done, well, we're on the road, but we're not there yet. So now I can't leave Cambridge.
Okay.
Well, I will visit some other place.
I don't know what I would have done if you'd said, you know what, now that you say it, I think I'm going to leave Cambridge. And then
we
would have broken that
you.
News, and then the whole city council would have been upset.
We could use you up here.
Do you ever get to Vermont?
Yes, I do. I used to go to Farwell,
which
is in Newbury, Vermont.
Oh,
so
I don't.
I've been there more than a few times. Vermont is a beautiful country. I love it, and I would enjoy taking my partner and I taking the ride up there and stay a couple of nights and come back and, you know, re-enter the I call it the chaos. But it's a good chaos.
It's a good chaos. Well, one of the other stories, as I was doing some other research, one of the stories in the week's news this week was about New Mexico, and it was about New Mexico. The New Mexico Senate voted down a measure to create a domestic partnership system, and it wasn't so much about the vote and how not surprised people were about it, but this woman, Linda Siegel, a lobbyist for Equality New Mexico, said to a crowd gathered outside the Capitol, "The people in this building said, you are not equal, you are not worthy, you do not deserve the same rights as most of them here." And it was very much, and she said, "If you're mad, you should be mad." And one of the things that we talk about on this show a lot, and we talked about with Evan Wolfson when he was on a few months ago as well, was about what emotions should really fuel us to keep us going. And you are our first elected official. So what should drive us? How I don't mean to be so general as to say, how do we make a difference? But we talk so much about how do we channel some of that anger that we're perhaps feeling to make some change?
You know, I always say determination.
Yeah.
You have to be determined. You have to set your sights on the goal, and you have to realize that there are going to be peaks and there are going to be valleys, but you keep going until the job gets done. If you think about marriage equality, you know, part of, although we were overjoyed in 2004, that was a very long road.
Right.
And there were lots of setbacks. And so you just have to say, this is important. This needs to be done. This is my goal. And I'm going to stick with it. And I'm going to bring other people along so that the journey, though it's a long and a hard journey, you're not doing it by yourself. You really just can't be turned around. And even in those dark moments, and I know about dark moments. So, you know, I remember when we were going, once the Supreme Court made its decision in November of the previous year, the days and weeks that we go to the State House and the people that were against marriage equality were organized, they
oh,
were
boy.
Loud, and they were determined that they were going to set us all back. And I remember the votes that would be cliffhangers, and you say, "Oh my gosh, is we going to, you know, are we going to lose this vote?" But we stayed at it, even though there were times we thought we weren't going to get it done. We just stayed at it,
and you kept going.
You just have to stay with that determination, and realize often when you think you're by yourself that you're not. There are people out there that do support you, and they do rise to the occasion. So for me, it's about just being determined.
Now, you're on the other side of the coin of being an elected official. What is that like, just in terms of we talk with so many community members, and it was so great to read that one of your platforms is civic participation, because we're deep in Vermont of town meeting and that town meeting structure, and so it's great to see that all over the place. What is the power in terms of being an elected official? Do you sometimes feel like you can make more of a difference? Do you sometimes yearn for, you know what, I would like to go back to being a citizen and having more free rein on what I'm fighting for? What has that experience been like for you?
Well, by being a politician, it does open doors that would not be normally open to
okay.
People take your phone calls.
Oh, well, that's a good thing.
you know. you could get the meeting that as a private citizen you might have to, I call hurry up and wait for, you can get as an elected official. As much, if nothing, for no other reason, no less of a reason than as a courtesy. But the important thing is you've gotten in the door. And when you get in the door, your issue gets in the door with you. And you get to rally face-to-face to that policymaker, that CEO, that church leader, that business leader, whoever the contact person you're trying to reach, you get that opportunity. And that's one of the benefits of being an elected official, is being able to have those opportunities. Not only do you have the opportunities of getting a face-to-face interview or a face-to-face sit-down talk, but you get to bring your constituency group with you. You know, one of my very favorite quotes comes out of a book written by Paul and Giddens called When and Where I Enter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the punchline. It says, when and where I enter, the whole race enters with me. So when I get that meeting, the GLBT community enters with me. So we all take a seat and we're saying, this is what we not want. This is what we need for our community. You know, if it's, you know, getting passage of ENDA, if it's getting marriage equality, if it's getting representation in our schools, if it's having a welcoming school program, these are the opportunities that, as an elected official, you get to place in front of people, and they listen to you because you've got that position, you've got that power.
Now, for those of us who perhaps have too sordid of a past to run for elected office, I'm just saying perhaps. As a private citizen, where we were talking earlier, one of my pet peeve issues, one of my big issues in the LGBT community is the inability for gay men to, because of government regulations, to donate blood. And I often think, well, gosh, what should I do? I've written letters and I don't really know what to do. Should I get people together? I'm not an elected official. What should I do?
You do both. First of all, you get people that are like-minded and you organize, and then you go to your elected official and you push and you continue to rally support. Sometimes that support comes from a local church or a local organization, but you first have to organize. You organize and then you continue to go to that elected official, and particularly if you support it, because where I thought you were going to go with this is, you know, if you're not an elected official, what do?
Right.
You go to elected official and you work with them and for them. You know, and we're all very, very proud and elated that President Obama is the president. And some people say, oh, well, our job is done. No, our job isn't done. It's really just begun. Because you have to support him in order to make sure that he keeps the promises that he made to all of us. And that's why we supported him. So when you go to that elected official that you helped get elect, or that ward person that you helped get elect, or that town meeting person that you supported, you say, I supported you because I know that you were going to stand up for my issue. Now I need you to stand up for my issue. But you also need to support that person so that they, when they look in the room and they're facing down that issue in town meeting, they know that you have their back.
Yeah. How have those town meetings been for you? They just look like an amazing experience.
They have been fabulous. They've been fabulous because the way we've done two models. The very first model was we showed a film that sort of gave the picture of the GLBT community, because somehow people think the GLBT community is something different. You know, we look different, we behave different.
Right.
So
right.
One was just to present the community. Then we had a general speaker that sort of set the tone. We broke into small groups and we looked at what some of the issues were. But the best part, in my opinion, was when we reported back what came out of those small groups. So what I did was I lined up the elected officials, the administration, and their job was to take notes and listen.
Huh.
Retrieve that information and then take the next year or two to work on some solutions. And that's how we've sort of modeled it. And it's a really great way to do it, because you first want to get the issues out there.
Right.
You can't turn around the problem, whatever they may be. Immediately, you have time. You need time to work on them. So it gave us, the government, a working plan. One of the things that came out of that very first town meeting was our Project 10 East program, which is our Gay Straight Alliance.
Yeah.
At our high school, did not have an executive director. It was basically unfunded, underfunded, no leadership. It wasn't going to go anywhere. It was going to sort of wither on the vine. And because that came up in the town meeting,
a small group of people that will later became the GLBT Commission and just went before the school committee and said, we really need this position funded. It was funded.
See?
The program's strong and growing. The other thing that came out of the GLBT town meeting was that people felt that the police needed to be more sensitive to GLBT issues. We small group of people got together, went to the commissioner, the training happened.
Any opposition there?
That's what we're working on, is the whole training the police department on the issues of transgenderism, being transgender.
Right.
I watched that word badly. so that they can be cognizant and more aware when they run into a transgender individual.
And have you run into opposition in trying to institute those trainings?
No, actually. You know, that's what's really great about living in Cambridge. Cambridge is proactive and progressive.
Oh.
And we don't get the pushback. You know, the police commissioner said, you know, and I was present when he said it, let's sit down and talk about it. I want to be able to address this issue. So he was very open and affirming about having a discussion about how we can have a discussion about the nuances and the issues that his police force need to be mindful of when dealing with the transgender community.
That's progress.
It is
progress.
That's huge progress.
It's a model for other cities. If we can do it in Cambridge, and this is why I can't leave Cambridge, because once we've done it, then we've got to show other people how to do it.
Yes. Now, we have to get you on the psychologist couch for a second, which we do with all of our guests who request songs, and figure out what these songs say about you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Let's start with Son of a Preacher Man. Why that song? What's one of my favorites?
It is. It's one of your favorites?
Me too.
Oh, it's one
Me
of my
too.
Favorites.
It's one of your favorites. I think it's because it's sort of the... It's a little bit of... I'm trying to think of... Don't let this get out. The country western side of me.
No one's listening. It's okay. Oh, it's the country western side of you.
The country western side of me.
Oh, my gosh. Don't let that get out.
I like the melody. You know, it's a lot less of the words, but more about the melody.
And how about I Feel the Earth Move? That's a great one, too. And I have to tell you, we have people instant messaging us all over the web right now saying, this is the best night of songs ever. So people are very into your song selections for tonight.
Oh, that's good.
So you got to stand by them.
It's more about Carole King.
Yes.
Liking her music, you know. So it's you know, she could sing Row, Row Your Boat, and it'd be great.
She would write it better than that, though.
She probably would.
She probably would.
My favorite of the favorites, and I had to, you know, you said five, but, you know, I really had 10.
Well, you can come back another time.
Right. Well, I'm going to switch the list a little bit because as I really thought about it some more, I said, oh, then I have to tell them, you know, one of my favorite artists is Patti LaBelle.
Oh, yeah, Patti.
I love Patti LaBelle. And there was a song that she did that actually Sylvester did it as well. It was You Are My Friend. Have you ever heard that?
I don't know that one.
I do.
Oh.
Becca knows it.
It's a good one.
It's a good one. It's sort of on the order of my Aretha Franklin choice, You'll Never Walk Alone, which really speaks to, and I mentioned this earlier in the interview when we talked about how you get things done, and I said the elected official needs to have their back, that you never walk alone. So in that same vein is You Are My Friend, and if you get a chance to play it, that one and one other that I want to just... mentioned that's not on my playlist, but I wanted to mention it to you because it's a great song. It's a remake by Olita Adams, and it's called I Have Hope You Dance.
Oh
yeah, that's a good one.
Is it the remake of the Leanne Womack song?
Right.
Oh, I only know Get Here by Olita Adams because it's such a New York City karaoke staple.
Oh, that's a great song too. But when she did I Hope You Dance, one of the things. One of the things I do in addition to being the mayor is I'm a justice of the peace. I've had a lot of opportunities to do weddings.
And you could have come and done my wedding on Sunday night.
Oh, but you would have had to come to Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah, there's that.
Yeah.
Oh, you and your details, Mayor Simmons. You and the law.
What with there being no gay marriage in Vermont yet?
Yes, no, it's our civil union.
But you're on your way.
We're on our way.
Vermont really, in a lot of ways, really should take a bow because they were the front runners when it came to civil unions. Massachusetts is happy to have marriage because marriage is what it is, marriage, and it's not
right.
Something that one has to interpret for somebody. But Vermont took that first daring step from which Massachusetts could step off from to the next level, which is marriage equality.
Well,
which is actually why I'm here now. See, I moved to Massachusetts, made sure that gay marriage got passed. I went to Cambridge, made sure you got elected, and now I'm back in Vermont. I'm going to make some stuff happen here.
Where goes Becca, so goes LGBT equality.
That's right.
That's fantastic.
We're working
Becca,
on
I had
it.
No idea.
If we need any help, we'll have to come back and get Becca, but just on loan.
Okay.
She's only going back if that number 76 bus gets...
77.
Number 77 bus. She's been griping about that bus, Mayor
it's
Simmons,
true.
Ever since we booked you.
We had no control of the 77.
I know.
Spoken well.
But you know what? That's the only negative thing I have to say about Cambridge.
No, Becca's in
bus.
Full nostalgic mode.
Well, I miss Cambridge.
Mayor Simmons.
I want you to be my mayor again. I'm coming back just for you.
Okay.
We are officially naming you the honorary mayor of this show, if that's okay with you.
Oh, that's fabulous.
So you are now it's a resume builder. Trust us.
Okay.
We expect to see this in your bios in the paper from now on.
The official mayor of this show is so gay.
So gay. Mayor Simmons, it is just an absolute honor and such a treat to have you call into our show. We wish you all the best. You're doing such great things in Cambridge. I love that the adjective that we see about you all the time in the articles is fiery and effective.
And vibrant.
I don't think there are better adjectives out there.
I think not.
Except determined.
But, the pleasure is also mine. It's great to chat with you, Ken, and Becca. Becca, when you come to Cambridge, there's a place for you at City Hall waiting to say
wow.
Hello.
Wow.
Excellent.
And Ken, we take Vermonters, too.
I'm a New York City guy. I'm just a transplant.
My partner is a New York City gal.
Yeah, look at that. I came up here.
See, it all works out.
Yeah, I took that PhD from New York City and I ran up here. So here we go. And I'll stick with Vermont a little longer. See, Becca, that's as close as we're going to get you to getting the key to Cambridge. Is there an actual key to Cambridge somewhere?
There is a key to Cambridge, but you got to come to Cambridge to get it.
Wow. It's sitting right next to that blue flower that's all laminated in her office.
That's right.
That's where
it's
freeze
dried or something.
All right, Mayor Simmons, we're going to let you get back to doing some governing. So,
it's a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Keep doing all the amazing things that you are doing over Cambridge. You guys truly are a model for what we're all aspiring to be, particularly with civic participation.
Absolutely.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thanks, Kel. Be well.
Have a great night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bees do it, even educated fleas do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. In Spain, the best upper sets do it.
Well, that's it for our first ever highlight show. We say it all the time, and I'm going to say it right now again. We are so appreciative. We appreciate our guests. We appreciate the LGBT and ally community and all the great work folks are doing out there. And, of course, we appreciate you for listening. So, on behalf of Becca, this is Ken. Get out there, have a great week, and remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?